Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. On the program today, big business and the Hoosier State, how a small business decides whether to get much, much bigger, and our series, I've Always Wondered. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Monday, the 30th of March. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. I don't know that Governor Mike Pence of Indiana ever really figured he would be in the very sharp crosshairs of the CEO of arguably the most influential company on the planet. But in the event, that is exactly what has happened. Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, as well as the people who run Salesforce and Yelp, have all taken very public stands against Indiana's Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which Governor Pence signed into law Thursday. These CEOs have said they will either work against the law or cut back on how much business they do in that state, rare departures from the delicate balancing acts that CEOs usually have to do. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
When a CEO drags his or her company into the highly exposed, highly charged world of causes, politics, and issues, there is a basic obvious concern. Will this affect the business? Stephen David Off Solomon teaches at UC Berkeley School of Law. He says a CEO stand will always be unpopular with some, but it could be popular with others.
Sometimes it furthers the corporation's mission. People like to buy causes these days.
But why get embroiled at all?
CEOs are people, too. Surprising as that may sound.
CEOs do have strong feelings on issues. They donate politically, for example, but that's usually private.
You don't very often see a CEO of a public company taking a public stance on a controversial issue without the CEO going first to the board.
Donna Dabney is executive director of the Conference Board Governance Center, and basically she says the CEO will usually first get permission, which directors are increasingly apt to grant.
CEOs and companies nowadays are feeling that they should speak up on societal issues.
But having the board on board doesn't mean it'll go well. John Coffey teaches law at Columbia.
I'm afraid Starbucks found the experience of dealing very candidly with race, even though it was a commendable effort, to have been something that went rather embarrassingly awkward for the company.
And really, every company does things differently, he says. Some have business policy committees to control corporate image and corporate mouths extra tightly. Others will let a CEO live his or her life, as long as they don't reduce shareholder value. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
While ever more bewildering revelations about the Germanwings crash last week continue to come out, some part of that conversation is now moving to compensation for the victims and their families, and what the details of how what happened might matter in that. Marketplace's Adam Ellington reports now on the international agreements that will help decide who pays how much.
The victims of the Germanwings crash are subject to unlimited compensation. That's the language used by an international agreement called the Montreal Convention. Mark Dombrov practices aviation law for McKenna, Long & Aldrich. What that means is the courts will decide compensation for each victim according to a fairly standard calculation.
The age, the income, the earning capacity, marital status, education.
Punitive damages designed to punish a company in cases of willful negligence are another matter entirely, but Dombrov says they don't apply under the treaty.
But let's hypothecate that they did everything wrong. The fact is, under the international agreement, it wouldn't matter. You still cannot get punitive damages.
Some compensation claims may yet argue negligence on the part of Lufthansa. Mary Schiavo is an attorney and former inspector general of the U.S. Department of Transportation. The fact that two pilots were not required to be in the cockpit will likely still come up in court.
And did they know that that could have left it open to sabotage or pilot suicide? Of course I'd argue that, and I will argue that if I'm involved in the case. And they should have known that. So am I saying that there's no way they won't have additional liability? No.
Schiavo estimates total payments will likely reach into the hundreds of millions of dollars, which is well short of the $1.5 billion insurance policy that nearly all airlines carry per flight. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, traders were in a buying mood. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was a story in the New York Times today that made you just stop and go, wait, what? There are apparently tens of thousands of homeowners in this country who, thanks to the mortgage meltdown and the ensuing foreclosure crisis, haven't made a mortgage payment in years. 5 years, to be precise, and who are still in their houses and might never have to leave them. Michael Corkery had the byline in the Times today. Michael, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
This is a somewhat extraordinary headline on this article, man. Foreclosure to home free as 5-year clock expires. It is fundamentally about the statute of limitations here.
That's right. It's an interesting, if surreal, twist in the foreclosure crisis that never seems to end in this country. People in states like Florida, New York, New Jersey, where lenders have to sue to evict you from your house if you're delinquent on your mortgage. Many of these cases, thousands of them, have gone on for so long that they're up against the statute of limitations in some of these places.
Is it just that the courts are so clogged with these cases that they cannot be gotten to in due time?
That, I think, was the case early on. Much of that backlog has filed through. Right. This is a situation where the delay is the result of a lot of different factors. And one of those factors is that lenders took a long time trying to figure out whose mortgages they were willing to modify and how they would do it. And, you know, we've heard a lot of those stories of missing documents, asking repeatedly for homeowners to send the same documents and to verify income over and over again. And that took years to kind of work through. And so these are just being litigated very heavily by both sides.
The great part about this woman you wrote about down in Miami is that she doesn't pay her mortgage of $1,300 a month, but she does pay her lawyer $500 a month.
Yes, it's turned out to be pretty good strategy in terms of being able to keep her house.
Right.
She believes she's got a good case. Her lawyers believe she's got a good case to get it dismissed. And that's the rub. If you're up against a statute of limitations and the case is dismissed, and these cases get dismissed for all sorts of reasons, technical reasons, people don't show up for hearings. And if it gets dismissed and the statute of limitations has elapsed, the lender can't refile the case, and you're basically home free. You can live in your house. You can rent it out, pass it on to your kids. The only recourse the bank does have is they can put a lien on the house. And so if you want to resell it, you have to pay off that lien first.
I was struck by something that Mark Zandi, the often quoted chief economist at Moody's Analytics, said in this piece. Housing crisis is going to take 10 years to work through the system. He said, so we've got like another year or two to go from the peak in 2006.
I know. It's amazing to think. I mean, you know, while the economy and the housing market aren't going gangbusters, they're certainly better. And yet this foreclosure issue and this mortgage issue is still sputtering away. There's still thousands of people in their houses who haven't paid a mortgage in now going on 6 years. They're still trying to get modifications. They're still going through the courts. And it's hard to even think that, you know, when you look around, things look better, but this issue is still far from resolved.
Michael Corkery, writing today in the New York Times about foreclosures. Michael, thanks very much.
Thanks very much.
Oil prices took another dip today. A barrel of U.S. crude is down around $48 as of the close this afternoon in New York. There are, as you know, a bunch of reasons. The possibility that Iranian oil may relatively soon be back on the market is one. The fact that we are running out of space to store all the oil that is being pumped is another. Also, the rising dollar. When the greenback goes up, oil prices go down because why? Marketplace's Patty Hirsch and John Buckley have put together an explainer.
Oil for sale. Appetizing light sweet crude for sale. Good morning. Crude and unusual oil sales. Eamon speaking.
Hello, Eamon. This is Serge.
Hello, Serge. Great to hear from you. The usual order, is it? 100,000 barrels?
Well, Eamon, I don't know. How much is oil today?
Well, still a bargain at $50 a barrel, Serge. Same as January 1st.
Will you take euros, my friend?
I will not, Serge.
But you're in Ireland, where you use euros, and I'm in France, where we use euros. So why can't you use euros?
Because I'm in the oil business, Serge. And we do business in dollars. Not rubles, not yen, not euros, dollars.
Ah, you know, this is killing me.
I do.
You know that every day the dollar is going up and that I have to pay more in euros to buy those dollars.
I do.
So you know that while some people think the price of oil isn't moving, it is in fact getting more expensive for people like me.
I do.
But you don't care.
I do not.
Well, my old friend, in that case I have no choice but to cut my order.
Cut your order?
Yes, old chum. I require just 50,000 barrels of oil today.
50? Not 100.
50.
Now you're killing me, Serge. You'll be leaving me swimming in oil.
I'm sorry, you leave me with no choice.
Oh, yeah, but tell you what. How about I just cut the price? Just a wee bit.
$35 a barrel?
What? No way. 49.
47.
Ah, 48. That's the best I can do.
$48 a barrel? You have a deal, mon ami. I luxuriate in the irony that as the dollar increases in value, the price of oil recedes.
Damned economics.
They talk like that around the office, too, believe me. John Buckley, Patty Hirsch. Coming up.
And if you travel around the country, you don't want to see the exact same flower.
But why not? Well, we'll tell you on our series, I've Always Wondered. But first, let's do the numbers. My goodness gracious, it's Monday. The Dow Industrial's up 1.5%, 263.17,976. The NASDAQ rallied 1.1%, 56 points, finished at 49.47. The S&P 500 up 1.2%, 25 points, 2,086 at the bell. Financial stocks took in some big deposits. J.P. Morgan Chase bulked up 2.3%. Goldman Sachs picked up 1.5%. Deal Mania lifted healthcare stocks. United Health Group, the nation's biggest insurer, raised up 2.5% on news it would buy Catamaran. That's a drug benefits manager. Catamaran sailed into a 23% gain. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.95%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. Daytime Emmy noms are announced tomorrow. And in other entertainment news, AC/DC's Angus Young turns 60. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Riznall. Grow or die, that's the business imperative, right? It is also, to some degree, the academic and nonprofit imperative as well, which helps explain the news out of Beijing today. The Rhodes Trust, the organization that offers the very prestigious scholarships of the same name, is expanding to mainland China. Students in the world's second biggest economy will now be able to apply and perhaps win an all-expenses-paid trip to study at Oxford. But as Marketplace's Sally Herships reports, it is a business proposition for the Rhodes Trust as well.
In China, if you go abroad to study, you are called an overseas turtle because you swam away to college.
That's right, and then swim back to the home country. And they call local people who have never been educated overseas as a local turtles.
Beibei Bao is an analyst with Rhodium Group, an economic research firm.
So there are different classes in China, you know, that really have a lot of mental impact on people.
Bao says in China, education is seen as a sign of social status, and a new market has sprung up, offering classes to help students apply for elite education abroad. Tim Katzman just got back from China yesterday. He's with Francis Parker, the private day school in San Diego that helps prep Chinese students for foreign programs. He says the Chinese appetite for Western academic training is growing.
And any leg up or advantage that they feel, or their parents or school administrators feel, that they can capture by coming to the United States is extraordinarily attractive to students and their parents in China.
Katzman says for Western prep schools, this is a gold rush. And expanding to China may be attractive financially to the Rhodes Trust, too. Tony Carnevale is director of Georgetown Center on Education and the Workforce.
If the Rhodes people want to extend, they're going to have to reach out to other parts of the world and include them, both in funding Rhodes scholarships, but more importantly, in finding the scholars themselves.
The Rhodes Trust says it is eager to expand, and hopefully, starting with Chinese population of 1.3 billion, it will get a few new applications. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
We do a lot of small business stories on this show. Rarely, though, do they come with dessert, pie specifically. About 10 minutes from Marketplace World headquarters here in downtown L.A., there is a pie shop that is doing really, really well. It's called The Pie Hole. And when we were there the other day at like 10 in the morning, it was packed. They've got three stores in all, including one out at the airport, LAX. And they have been approached by, shall we say, overseas investors with an interesting proposition. Think big, like international franchising big. But making that decision when you're still a pretty small business is pretty complicated.
We do pie that no one else does.
I asked co-founder Lindsay Hefner to explain how they got to this point.
I've been with Matt, my husband, for 11 years, and growing up, he kept listening to his mother say, you know, one day, maybe I'll have a pie shop. And she was a nurse, completely different field. And we sat around one Thanksgiving, and Becky, my mother-in-law, made pies. Famously, I said with a mouthful of her lemon meringue, we should open, expletive, a pie shop. She doesn't love the way I said it, but she does love that I said it. And we started talking with a family friend of ours, Sean, about this idea, and right away, he goes, this is fantastic. Let's do this.
Oh, look, Sean's right here.
Sean is.
So they come to you with this idea, and you said, fantastic. But clearly, there's some business calculation going on in your mind.
Well, this was almost 4 years ago, and the economy was not in a good place.
Yeah.
People were not spending a lot of money going out for fancy dinners, but they still needed to have a nice meal. We really thought the perfect antidote was comfort food. So we scrabbled as much money as we could together, maxed out our credit cards. We knew that there was something special there, so we thought we'd give it a shot.
You now have an opportunity to franchise this place.
Right.
How did that come about, and where's it going to go?
We were really worried about becoming a chain restaurant where they're ubiquitous. You can find a pie hole everywhere. And the problem with that is, you know, the idea of a chain is that there's this massive warehouse pumping out,
right,
machines pumping out,
right,
products where there's no connection to humanity.
And pretty soon you guys were unwrapped with industrial food,
right,
and boom. And
exactly.
Filling getting dumped in and all that jazz.
And franchising has such a bad connotation
to it.
Well,
yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit.
And so people hear that and they immediately think, everything's going to go away. All of the mom and pop touch is going to go away. And we have been, you know, tirelessly trying to ensure them that that is not our intention. And that would be the last thing we would want.
So how do you, though, if you're going to have, conceivably, a pie hole in London and one in Rio and one in Moscow and then one maybe in Shanghai, how do you keep that vibe, right? I mean, are there companies you look at who are doing it well, who you say, oh, yeah, we could do that?
Of course. We always are looking at great models. I mean, put everything we have into this, and it's because we love it, and we would not feel the same way if all of a sudden we're dealing with a monolith of pie somewhere, you know, trying to open up as many shops as we could.
But, to, you know, like, on that question, because that's what we ask ourselves,
right,
and we know people are going to ask us, but you have to take that opportunity if it comes to you because, I mean, you're crazy not to in a way. You have a great amount of control, more than people, I think about with franchises. They think with franchises, they just think, oh, Subway, okay, I get the book, here's some bread,
right,
I'm going to throw some salami
like
on here.
Right.
And that's not how it is. This is my mother-in-law, Becky, this is her dream. And we have to answer to her because we have somebody's, like, you know, dreams in our hands. That means a lot to us.
What happens if you guys do decide to expand in a not small way and you don't like the way it's going? Then what happens? What happens if it goes bad?
Well, things did go wrong with LAX, for sure. We have we can shut it down if we want. It's in the contract. If we show up and we don't like what we see, they're violating our brand. Say, for example, I do all our social media. So when people take pictures and tweet about LAX, I caught somebody wearing a hat backwards. So we called down there and said, can't wear the hat backwards. So, you know, that's the difference is, like, we don't have a company doing our social media. You know, it is us. I always say, if you email Piehole, you're going to get an owner. You're not just going to get some, you know, random person answering emails. It's us. We are that hands-on, and we plan to continue to be that hands-on.
I need to buy like 5 or 6 pieces of pie to take back. So let's go over there to the case,
okay, cool.
And you guys point me at your favorite ones.
See, everything on the second shelf is what we consider our favorites or what we're known for.
I'm going to have the Earl Grey.
Whole Earl Grey.
A whole Earl Grey, a whole maple custard, and then she's going to pick 3 savories for me.
Chicken and cornbread, steak and ale, and the mac and cheese.
We've got the Piehole's top 5 tips for making pie on our website. It is marketplace.org, and we're going to go back in a couple of months to see how that franchising thing is going and to get more pie. If you travel for work or for pleasure, you will at one point or another find yourself in a hotel room. And you might, maybe just as you check in or if there's nothing you want to watch on cable, turn your attention to the art that's on the wall, those seemingly generic pictures or prints that somebody took the time to put there. And maybe you'd say to yourself, huh, I wonder why they picked those. Good thing, then, that we've got a series geared for just those musings. It's called I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blade work.
Stan Alcorn is up this week with a question from listener and amateur photographer Aaron Batchelor, who got an email from his mom while she was on vacation in the Grand Canyon.
She sent me some photos that were hanging on the wall, and she said, boy, these look a lot like yours. And I thought, where do these hotels buy, you know, that kind of artwork?
Here's Stan.
It depends on the hotel owner.
My name is Hung Luck.
Luck is a developer with the Lam Group in New York.
We manage many different brands from Marriott, Starwood, Hilton.
All these familiar chains are franchises, like McDonald's or Burger King. Lam and thousands of other owners pay to share the name, the reservation system, and yes, the look. Terry Brooks is the director of product quality for Hilton Garden Inn.
A lot of our guests stay with us consistently, no matter what city they're in. So we want them to see some consistency to the brand.
And what does that brand look like?
For Hilton Garden Inn, I would describe it as light, bright, airy, very professional but approachable.
Those airy qualities can translate into very concrete design guidelines. They can dictate color palette, furniture style, even specific artwork, according to hotel developer Hung Luck.
When I first got started, I remember the franchise community would say, pick A, B, or C art options.
There were a lot of posters of landscapes and flowers.
And if you travel around the country, you don't want to see the exact same flower.
But the reason the same flower poster was in a lot of rooms back then wasn't just the brands.
It used to be just poster art where everything was on paper and what you saw is what you got.
That's Puneet Basan with the Artline Group in Hicksville, New York. His company helps hotels find art, but when he got started 20 years ago, they could only point them to catalogs full of mass-produced posters.
The designer would say, send me a catalog, and then we would literally mail them hundreds of catalogs, and they would choose the image based on that.
If they didn't like the options or wanted to tweak the size or the color, too bad.
But now, with the digital age, all the items are digitized, so you can make them whatever color you want, you can make them whatever size you want, you can print on anything you want.
These are like MDF boards, which is basically like a hard type of
like wood?
That's Tony Bracco, one of Artline's graphic artists. He can actually print a drawing onto one of these boards or all sorts of other materials.
These are aluminum.
But even more importantly, he can print anything from a digital library of hundreds of thousands of photos, drawings, and paintings. The licensing fees to do that can be as little as a couple bucks a copy if it's a big order. And Bracco says this digital approach also means Artline can accommodate more custom requests. Take the Radisson Martinique in Midtown Manhattan.
What they wanted to do was a collage with the Chrysler Building, street signs, the Brooklyn Bridge, street maps, and they had a specific color set. They wanted blacks, whites, and golds.
In the lobby of the Martinique, there are two of these commissioned works across from the bathrooms.
So it's kind of like you have your artwork hanging in this hotel now.
Yes, but it doesn't have our names on it, unfortunately.
Then again, to put the names of everyone who helped make this piece of art, the photographers, the designers, the brand managers, that probably wouldn't fit on the canvas. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
This is obviously the kind of series that doesn't work without you and your questions, so drop us a line. Let us know what you have always wondered. You can do it at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, for those of you who loved Carrie Underwood in NBC's live broadcast of The Sound of Music a couple of years ago, or Allison Williams in Peter Pan this past December, or who just loved to watch Twitter as these things were airing, big, big news. NBC announced today its next spectacular will be The Wiz. Airs in December. Cirque du Soleil will help produce, which ought to be interesting. No cast announcements just yet. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 1.5% today, 263 points. The NASDAQ gained 1.1%. That is 56 points. The S&P 500 up 1.2%, 25 points on that particular index. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder and Daisy Palacios. Yes, just the two of them. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.